Hello and welcome to another edition of the Renatus podcast. For listeners not familiar with Renatus, we're a Dublin-based private equity company that provides investment capital to ambitious Irish companies. My name is Greg Dilger and I'm delighted to be joined today by Peter Jackson, the Group CEO of Flutter Entertainment, one of the largest players in the global gaming industry and owner of brands such as Paddy Power, Betfair, Sky Betting and Gaming and FanDuel, among others. I'm guessing Flutter is a much bigger business than most people realize. The market cap at its current share price levels is around $32 billion. It really is a phenomenal Irish success story, and the story is far from over. Today I'm going to talk to Peter about the past, the present and the future. And before that, just Peter, you might give us a minute or two about your own background and experience before you became Flutter CEO in 2018.
Well, how long have you got, Greg? Because I can give you the short version or the long version. But in the interest of your listeners' time, why don't I give you the short version?
Great.
So I'm originally from Yorkshire, proud Yorkshireman, and I actually worked for Arthur Andersen in the tax department in Leeds before I went to university, okay. Which was a brilliant start, and I would recommend it to everybody if you get the chance to get into a bit of a profession. But my father was in the motor trade, so I used to enjoy going and working with him, whether that was washing cars or buying and selling cars, which I did a bit of as well. But after university, I went to work at McKinsey. I was there for several years, worked in media and entertainment. I was then in financial services, splitting my time between Yorkshire and London. I then went to go and run a private equity-backed business called Travelex, which was my first opportunity to be a CEO. There's probably another podcast in the stories about that that experience.
Noted.
But whilst I was there, one of the things I was conscious of was that we may well end up IPOing the Travelex business at some point, and I didn't have any public market experience. And so I decided to join the board of a PLC. And I had always been fascinated by challenger brands. So I'm sure this will come up in our conversation.
Yes.
And I actually, when I looked at it, I was talking to a headhunter about the about Betfair, and it was a perfect example of a challenger brand in the gaming sector. And so I joined the board of Betfair, and the rest ended up being history. Of course, Betfair merged with Paddy Power. I stayed on the board. I was fortunate to be selected, and then when Brian decided he wanted to leave, I was part of the board subcommittee who was interviewing prospective new CEOs, and realized when I was talking to them that I had quite a strong view of what I thought we could do with the business. So I had to again have the rather uncomfortable conversation with the chairman to explain to him that whilst I hadn't found anyone, I fancied throwing my hat into the ring, and fortunately didn't fall off his chair, and I ended up starting at the beginning of 2018.
Am I right in thinking that Patrick Kennedy had a similar experience going from non-exec to CEO?
And it's happening more regularly now, actually. When you look at the numbers of non-execs who move from that position to running the businesses, it's always a good salutary lesson as to how little the non-execs know when you actually get your feet under the table there.
And was Brian Corcoran a difficult guy to replace? Because I know he had done very well, he had a very good reputation. Did you feel under some pressure coming into that
of course
job after
you know him? Yeah, I mean, you know, to follow Brian was no easy task, but we all do things in our own different ways, and I had my view of what I wanted to do, and that was going to be different to the way that Brian ran the business.
Peter, before talking about Flutter today and what your priorities are and what your strategy is and what's happening, maybe for a minute or two, just remind us of the corporate history as to how this entity came together, what the big landmarks were to give us what we have today. Because as far as I can see, it's a lot of people wouldn't know what's going on here. There's a lot of stuff happening. So maybe a quick reminder of the history of the company.
Yeah, we have been busy. in the last several years. I mean, I often joke with people, it's like dog years, you know, here, because of the amount of things that we get done. But, you know, look, I think if you go back to beginning of 2018 when I started, my thesis was that there were two things that were going to be very important for our industry, and that was sort of scale and diversification. And the reason those things were important was that our industry was no different to every other digital industry in that the economics flowed disproportionately to the scale player, and we wanted to be the scale player in the space. And scale in our context was on a sort of national basis as well as a sort of global basis. But you needed to have, what, you know, using the sporting vernacular, podium positions in the markets. It wasn't good enough just to be sort of number 10 in every market in the world and therefore be, you know, have scale. We needed to have real positions. At the time when I joined, the business was, you know, had resulted in the merger of Paddy Power and Betfair. And if you looked at the business we had at the time, obviously, you know, real strength in the Paddy Power business, you know, here in Ireland and in the UK. The Betfair business, you know, which is, you know, the exchange to go with the sports book, which is operating, you know, very strongly in the UK and Ireland, but also, you know, globally in the sort of the dot-com model. We had our sports bet business in Australia and a small nascent horse racing business together with a small online casino in the States. And the horse racing business is called TVG, and actually we operated the Betfair casino business in New Jersey. You know, so I had this view and this vision that we could create this, you know, business with scale and diversification. And so we, you know, we recognized we needed to grow the business organically, but also use M&A to expand and grow the business. So we set upon, you know, the journey you see today. And, you know, we acquired a business called Ajarabet, which gave us, you know, exposure to Georgia and Armenia. The business has, you know, gone on from strength to strength in that market. Not long after that, we bought FanDuel, which, you know, we did by sort of merging our assets we had in America together with FanDuel, which is a DFS business. So I have no doubt we'll talk about that at some stage. Along the way, we realized that we couldn't just keep adding all these brand names to our corporate identity. And we needed something that was, you know, more reflective of our, you know, of what we did, but didn't have any of our necessary sort of trading brands in the corporate name. And so we could have spent a lot of money with Wolf Olins or someone like that in identifying a brand, but we said, well, actually, you know, we're pretty good at these things ourselves. So we actually set a small team up internally to go away and have a think about it. And you know, they came up with some, you know, interesting, you know, potential Irish names that we could have used and various other things. But we actually had in the bottom drawer of the corporate history, you know, the name Flutter. If you go back long enough, in the early days of Betfair, the business actually merged with Flutter. And it was like one of these sort of good, you know, American-English marriages, because, you know, Flutter was American and Betfair was English at the time. You know, Flutter brought the money, and Betfair brought the technology, and the, you know, that's what helped create the success of Betfair. So we owned all the rights, the domain names and everything, but we just weren't using them. And if, when we looked at it, of course, it's a brilliant name for the company. So we decided to call ourselves Flutter Entertainment.
Entertainment is an interesting addition as well. It's a broader thing than just bookmaking.
Yeah, because we you know, we were more than just a bookmaker at the time, because we, you know, we obviously had extensive gaming businesses, but also aspirations to be doing more than that as well. So, you know, that's why we called ourselves Flutter Entertainment. And then along the way, there's been a lot of other sort of M&A that we've used to grow the scale of the business. You know, the most significant would have been the, you know, the merger with the Stars Group, where we, you know, ended up acquiring the Sky betting and gaming business. It gave us incremental scale in Australia, which, you know, led to us being the number one in that market. Of course, brought the PokerStars business as well, and also Foxbet, which was something we had to, you know, created a few headaches and heartaches for us. Subsequent to that, you know, we've bought Jungle E, which gives us access to the fast-growing rummy market in India. We also bought Seasal, which gave us, you know, much bigger position, the leading position in Italy, together with businesses in Morocco and Turkey. And you know, we have recently bought a business in Serbia as well. So you know, look, the onwards and upwards. Mm. We, you know, M&A has been an important part of the business. But you look at us today, we're now the world's leading you know, sports betting and gaming business globally. You know, we operate all of those brands and more around the world.
Like, how do you make money in Rummy? How does you bet on a horse, you win at 5-1, you get your money. How does Rummy work?
So you know, we operate Rummy, which is actually very similar to poker, and very similar to the Betfair exchange business, and also very similar to Tombola, which is another business we bought. They're all liquidity-based markets. So if you want to play a game of bingo, you go onto the Tombola app, and you're going to have a group of people you play with. Because actually, what happens is everyone enters the contest. You know, you put your 1 euro in to enter the contest, and what we do is we take a clip from all of the prize pool that's generated. We keep that, and then we distribute the rest of the prize pool to the winner, the second, third, fourth, fifth, etc. In the contest. You know, Rummy is very similar, poker is very similar.
But this is the diversity you're talking about in the portfolio. It's like, it's not like the traditional betting markets where you could have very large liabilities. This is different.
It's different from that diversification perspective. You know, diversification is also important from a regulatory perspective as well. So whether it's sporting results. So, if we were just a US business, it would have been very painful when, you know, the Seahawks NFL game happened, and we lost a lot of money on that, in the last American football season. Likewise, if we were just an Italian business, you know, January would have been cataclysmic for the business because, you know, margins are really poor in January. That diversification also helps us as well.
Can I just ask you about that one game, the Seahawks game that you lost money in? Do you accept it's part of your business that occasionally you're going to lose quite a lot, or do you hedge it as much as possible so you kind of try and create a fairly consistent margin, or you know, from time to time there's an event that's going to work, play badly or well for you, and you just have to accept that as an occupational hazard? Is that how it works?
The brilliant thing about sport is that when we sit down and watch the game, we don't know what the outcome is, and that's what makes it so exciting. And as you watch the game and the game unfolds, what I describe as, you know, the sort of the red thread develops, you know, the sort of the narrative of that match. And you know, who would have known, right, when Arsenal Chelsea were playing the other evening, that Chelsea were going to be thumped 5-0? Of course, after the event, we can all come up with a narrative of why the Chelsea team capitulated or why Arsenal were on such a tear. But before that happened, we really didn't know. And that's what makes sport so exciting. It's why people get together and watch it and enjoy it. But of course, from a bookmaking perspective, you know, we have to work out all the probabilities of the different outcomes. But we don't hedge, because if we did that, we wouldn't make any money. So we're very, you know, the core product for us as a bookmaker is our ability to assess those probabilities and then turn them into prices. And the, you know, the inevitable nature is that, you know, there will be a horse race or a soccer match or a tournament where we, you know, a boxing game, where we'll lose money.
Because you would have thought from an investor perspective, it would be more attractive if there was because of your volume and your market leadership, that you're able to make a kind of stable margin all the time. That would be good from their perspective, but it's probably not possible.
One of the benefits that we get from our global diversification is that some of those highs and lows between the different sporting events help balance each other out. You know, but ultimately, you know, it's my job to be able to sort of engage and talk, you know, to our shareholders about what we're doing. But I believe that our shareholders would rather we had a slightly more volatile, higher margin than a more stable, lower margin.
Because it's amazing. I worked in the financial services and stockbroking at one point, and I remember Paddy Power would come in for their sort of twice yearly talk to the analysts and stuff like that. But it was there was consistently talk of adverse results or good results happened in a particular time. But I can only imagine now that you're broader, your earnings are from different sports and different types of earnings. that's not, although you do mention the Seahawks again. So it's still, adverse results are still a factor when you're talking to investors from time to time.
Yeah, of course they are. Now, one of the things that we have as a US listed business mm-hmm. is the requirement to have quarterly results.
Yeah.
And of course, the shorter the time frame you take, mm-hmm. the more volatile the results are going to be. So, yeah. You know, that's something we have yeah. to live with.
Actually, just seeing as we're on the fact that you've now listed in the US and you're going to be doing a lot more investor relations work, I guess, there. Since you've listed, presumably you've been on some roadshows and gone to see investors existing and new. How have you found that since you're listing in the US? Has that been interesting?
The natural home for this business with, you know, the number one sports betting and now gaming business in America is for us to be listed on the US market. And that's why we decided to change our listing. We did so in January, and we hope our shareholders will be supportive of the switch to the primary listing. Yeah, along the years, I've engaged with shareholders in the US a long time. You know, 80% or so of, you know, global equities are sort of, you know, traded out of the US. So you'd anticipate and expect that, you know, US institutions would be large holders of our business, and indeed they are. So, you know, even before the listing, I would have spent a lot of time in the States talking to shareholders. You know, since we acquired our, you know, what is currently our secondary listing in America, of course, you know, we've been very engaged with US investors and potential investors.
Do the investors that you're meeting with, do they surprise you by their knowledge sometimes? Do you learn things from them? Are you coming away from a meeting saying that was interesting and taking it back into your job as such?
One of the most powerful things I think you can do in business is to look in different categories, different sectors, think about the problems that they've solved and think about how we can apply them in our business. Of course, these investors are not specialists investing in online sports betting in America. They're in
everything.
They invest in everything. Right? And so there's definitely things that we can learn, whether that's how to communicate the complexity of the business, you know, because it is a complex thing, and how we synthesize that for new investors, but also, you know, to listen and learn from them about the investments that they've backed, which have been in the sort of high growth phase like we are, and how to make sure we capitalize on that.
FanDuel, your US business, it's such a big part of your portfolio now, and there's very exciting possibilities coming there. Maybe remind us again of just the story of FanDuel, because you made a relatively small exposure to start with, and then you increased it subsequently. Remind us about what exactly was going on at the time. Bet that looks like it has been a strategic win for the company. It looks like it. So tell us a bit about the very origins of that.
Well, it's the sort of the 7-year overnight success story. You know, it's easy after the fact to look at the success we have in America and assume it was always going to be the case. But it hasn't been the case for other Western European
companies
who had what we had but didn't find ways to exploit it. I think we were relatively unusual, though, in that we had TVG, our horse racing business in the States. We had our iGaming business, online casino business in New Jersey. And we had a very nascent, small, you know, we'd acquired the number three DFS operator called Draft. Now, when we looked at the, you know, which gave us a sort of understanding of DFS. So DFS, for your listeners, is daily fantasy sports.
Yep.
So in America, sports betting was not allowed, and certainly not online. There were certain places you could do it, you know, in casinos. So, if, you know, so a sports book, you could go and place a bet like you would do in a betting shop. What daily fantasy was, and this was, you know, something that was pioneered by, you know, one of the founders of FanDuel, actually, who interestingly had worked at Flutter in the past.
Okay.
So when, you know, that business a long time ago. So, you know, what goes around comes around. And what they realized was that while sports betting was not allowed, they could create, instead of these sort of season-long contests that you may participate in, like, you know, so a football league where, you know, you change your players and, you know, you select them over the course of a season. What you could do with daily fantasy is you could have a contest that day or that evening, and your players would be ranked, and you'd have a sort of salary cap which you can use to acquire players who are going to play in the contest that day. And you know, you could enter a $10 entry fee contest. Okay. Yeah, the prize for coming first could be $100,000, could be $1 million. And so it was a way of letting people use their insights.
And that wasn't considered sports betting.
No, because it was a closed pool.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So, you know, the people were, you know, buying their, you know, their entry tickets into these contests. There were some questions and concerns, you know, initially about the, you know, the regulatory, you know, position of Daily Fantasy, but that was something that was resolved. So look, we looked at that and thought, well, you know, yeah, America's going to go down one of two paths. It's going to go down a path where PASPA, which was the legislation that was preventing you know, online sports betting from happening, PASPA will either be repealed, in which case, you know, happy days, sports betting can come into the market, or it won't, in which case DFS is going to be the only legal proxy that's available. Clearly, there was a lot of sort of illegal sports betting happening, which was, would obviously have carried on. So when we looked at it, we realized that if we wanted to fulfill our, you know, sort of ambition of creating this, you know, global scale leader, we needed to have a more significant business in America. And at the time, you know, FanDuel and DraftKings, you know, were losing money. They'd had a huge sort of head-to-head sort of battle over the years, but, you know, both were raising money. Both, you know, there were sort of transactions that could have been done with either of them. So we spent time looking at both businesses. And what we figured out was that at the end of the day, you know, whilst we had the betting knowledge and know-how, if PASPA was repealed, that was going to be very powerful. We didn't have a brilliant brand that was recognized in America, and we didn't have a big customer base. And so we'd have that sort of classic cold start problem where, you know, if people don't know your brand and you don't have any customers, it's very expensive to acquire your first customer, your second customer, third customer, before you start generating a sort of significant enough pool of customers that generate revenues to help pay for it. Whereas if we acquired, you know, FanDuel or another business like that, it would give us a ready-made group of customers, some revenues, something we could cross-sell into. So that's what we decided to do.
Was there an element of luck to getting your position in FanDuel, do you think, looking back on it? Because did they and DraftKings tried to get together? And
they tried to merge. That had been stopped.
Competition issues
had stopped it. So look, you know, but you know, look, I, you know, was it lucky? Were we trying to look at the US market and try and figure out what an each way bet was? You know, look, I mean, that's how we were thinking about it.
Yeah.
It was not an, you know, at the time when we announced it, you know, people didn't think it was an obvious thing to do. I think people were worried about, you know, the amount of money we'd spend. And for the first, you know, several years after acquiring FanDuel, every time we'd announce how much money we're investing in the US, you know, our shareholders were very nervous about it. And people would talk about it as a downgrade. You know, they thought we were throwing the money away.
Was, in terms of your board, was there nervousness? And how did all that work? Were some against it? Were some very strong for it? What kind of support had you got for that strategy?
The most important thing I can say about the board is that they've always been incredibly supportive over my years here at the company. And if I go back to those days when we were contemplating, you know, the FanDuel transaction, you know, the person who we first had to convince was me, right? You know, so the corp dev team was sort of looking at this. And, you know, I was a little bit nervous about it, right? I mean, it wasn't necessarily the obvious thing to do. We were looking at other opportunities in the States. And I was actually on my way to, I was going down to go and visit the team in Sportsbet. And I asked the corp dev team to send me all the materials we had and all the customer research and, you know, everything we had on it. Of course, you got 24 hours of your own company when you go to Australia. Mm-hmm. So I read through all the stuff. And at the end of it, it was so obvious to me that we should do this transaction and try and find a way of making it happen. So look, we pulled the paper together and went and spoke to the board about it. And, you know, everybody on the board was very supportive. You know, we all know that everything is big in America. And yeah, there was only really, sort of, you know, as I said earlier, right, two options, right? The sports betting was going to happen. If it happened, we believed that this was going to set us up incredibly well to be successful in the market. But if sports betting didn't happen, then, you know, actually the best proxy was daily fantasy. And that's what, you know, we'd want more scale in that as well. So it was relatively easy on that basis. Yes. Yeah, the harder thing was, it was actually then, you know, once sports betting, you know, was allowed, and you think about the amount of money that we had to start investing behind our business in the US, and yeah, some shareholder concern about whether it was the right thing to do, you know. You know, I remember at the time talking to some of our shareholders who pointed out that Paddy Power had spent a lot of money trying to build a business in Italy when sports betting had been you know, opened up there. And it hadn't worked. And it was true. It hadn't. You know, we'd really struggled to get the Paddy Power brand to get traction. Now, we had the what I would describe as the cold start problem. We didn't have that customer base. We didn't have that revenue pool. We didn't have people we could cross-sell into. And it's always really hard to get going in those situations, which is the challenge that we had with we had in Italy. What we knew was that we had a great brand. We had a fantastic product, right, that we could, you know, bring to the US consumer, and sort of enormous unmet need, and that was very powerful. Yeah, the one sort of anecdote I'll tell you about when we launched in the States, which sort of gave us a bit of comfort that, you know, we were onto something that was going to be successful. You know, we realized that, you know, we actually opened up a store effectively at the Meadowlands racetrack. It became one of the biggest turnover businesses that we have anywhere in the world from a retail perspective, because, you know, everything's big in America. But the first day we had no idea what was going to happen, and we realized we actually maybe needed to write some guides so that we could explain, like, the ladybird of betting to Americans. So we wrote all these pamphlets trying to explain how to bet. And of course, you know, the first customer turned up had been doing it for years. We didn't need any of them. And it made us realize there really was that sort of, you know, enormous unmet demand in the market. We were talking a little bit about the, you know, the FanDuel transaction, the support of the board. I mean, look, clearly, you know, when you're running a public company, you know, it is an unusual role, right? You know, it's quite lonely being the CEO. You've got all of these shareholders who can speak for their own piece, but they don't speak for the whole. It's very different to running as a private equity business. So the piece that becomes very important is your relationship with your chair and also with the board. And, you know, it was helpful for me to some extent that I had been on the board, you know, that I sort of moved to the other side of the table. So I knew all the board incredibly well. You know, we'd all spend lots of time hanging around in airports and, you know, pre and post board meetings. And of course, I had, you know, a good relationship with Gary. And I think, you know, look, that was Gary McGann's been a very important component of the, you know, the success that got us, to where we are today. And, you know, I think, you know, Gary and I had, you know, spent a lot of time together. That, you know, the best deals were probably the ones that we didn't do, you know, frankly, rather than the ones you see. And of course, you know, look, Gary, unfortunately, you know, reached the end of his, you know, tenure with the business and has moved on to do bigger and better things. And, you know, we've got a different chair, so John Bryant's in the business now, and I've got a good relationship with John, and, you know, he's based in the States, and, you know, that's helpful for the shifts we're making towards America as well. But
a very big issue is the legislative and regulatory background in the US, and some states allow betting, other states don't. A minute or two on the what are the big opportunities that are to come, and what are the opportunities and the sort of threats within that?
You're right, and yeah, the picture in the US, as is always the case in all the different markets you're operating, is always very different. In America, when PASPA was repealed, it effectively meant that it became a states' rights issue. So the states could decide. It wasn't a federal government issue. The states could individually decide if they wanted to allow sports betting and gaming to happen. New Jersey was the state that effectively, I mean, they took the federal government to the Supreme Court and won the case. That's how it actually happened. And so they were the first out of the blocks to allow sports betting. And so we launched very quickly in New Jersey. Pennsylvania followed. And look, there's been a succession of states that have passed legislation to allow sports betting or sports betting and online casino to occur in the markets. We're not yet at a position in America where everybody can do it. You know, I mean, I suspect that in the very long run, there'll still be a few states where it won't happen. So, you know, we don't believe that Utah, for example, would ever allow this to occur.
Yeah.
But, you know, states like California have not passed legislation, nor has Texas. In Florida, there's a monopoly, which the Seminoles, which, you know, is the tribe that is based in Florida, have a sort of monopoly over sports betting in that market, which they're sort of exercising through their owned asset, Hard Rock. So it's a very complex picture.
So you can't make a bet in Florida if you don't use them.
Correct. Correct. And you can't make a bet in California.
So presumably there are people betting in California. I don't know how they're doing it, but there must be betting going on in California. And if so, what are they doing right now?
In every market across the world, you know, people, you know, have been betting with each other, you know, against each other for a long time. You know, when we are able to operate a regulated, you know, in a regulated environment, allows the government to collect taxes. Yeah. But, you know, really crucially, it allows us to, you know, bring all of our tools, knowledge and capabilities to ensure that we create the right framework for customers so that they can, you know, protect themselves.
And Peter, what's the history of it? Why are those all the states against it? Why is it a bad thing?
The states aren't against it, but the state, you know, the starting point in the states is that unless the states pass the legislation, they're not allowed to do it. So a state like Texas, you know, if you speak to Texans, they'd love to be participating in sports betting. There is an inherent problem in Texas, though, which is they don't like passing any legislation at all. So much so that the state government only meets every other year. So you've got to work out when you can find time on the legislative, you know, agenda and support to get the bills, you know, put forward and subsequently passed. And unless those things happen, then sports betting on a regulated basis can't happen. And you know, look, I'm sure people find their way online with, you know, offshore bookmakers. You know, we know there's some, you know, very significant businesses serving the US market. So,
and is it, I've heard this, and I guess it's true, but if you're on the border of an area where it's allowed and you're crossing into a border or crossing over into a state that it's not allowed, that your phone pretty much won't work when you cross the border.
We have to use very, very, very accurate geolocation software as part of our application to very precisely determine where you are. I mean, there was a period in time where you weren't able to bet in New York, but you could in New Jersey. And, you know, if you've ever been to Manhattan, you know, you know there's a bridge between the two. Literally, when you got to, you know, a meter past the halfway point towards Jersey, you'd be able to start betting. Or, you know, coming the other way, it'd stop, you know.
Incredible. Talk about ESG, big issue for you. ESG, Peter, is a pretty huge issue in the investment world at the moment, and your business has got elements in it that are, you know, get people excited on that topic in terms of protecting people from themselves and all that kind of thing. Has that impacted your story a little bit? Do some funds walk away from it because it's a bit frightening from an ESG perspective, or how does it? How live is that issue for you?
We've got a very good story to tell around the work we do through what we describe as our positive impact plan. You know, I think, you know, as a very, you know, essentially sort of digital business, you know, we don't have a particularly large environmental footprint, so that's not a big issue for us per se. What is important for us when we think of, you know, we talk about our positive impact plan is play well. So it's ensuring that, you know, we think about how we help ensure that our customers are protected. We talk about what we're doing to drive diversity you know, within our own business, and also think about how we, you know, support and protect the communities with which we operate. And of course, you know, there is that environmental piece, but it's you know, it's less difficult for us, I guess. For the play well area, look, you know, we have always led the race to the top. This is an absolutely crucial topic for us. Mm-hmm. We invest a huge amount of money. Last year, we invested, you know, over $100 million on this across our business, in terms of, you know, the technology, mm-hmm. the training, the research that we're doing in this. It's absolutely paramount for us, and we spend an enormous amount of time ensuring that, you know, with the models and capabilities, that we, you know, stop customers from getting themselves into trouble. And look, you know, people ask me, what does that mean? Yeah, look, there are plenty of customers who we actually switch off their accounts, and we do not let them back with us. Right? In the countries which are more forward thinking, we're actually able to then share that data with other operators, so that they can make sure that they don't, you know, that they switch those customers off as well. And we allow customers to sort of exclude themselves from the, you know, the betting industry. There are some, you know, there are some customers who will encourage to put deposit limits on their account. Some customers encourage to take a break. So there's lots of tools and techniques we'll use. And, you know, we genuinely take, you know, revenues out of our business and reduce the, you know, the money the customers are spending with, because it's the right thing to do.
Another issue slightly related to that is money laundering. You know, again, coming from the financial world, money laundering is a huge issue, and the banks and institutions have huge processes to ensure. Presumably, that all of that responsibility, you have to deal with that as well.
I also worked in financial services, and, you know, if you came here, you'd see a very similar setup with the sort of the three lines of defense model that you'd be, and your listeners who are in that industry would be familiar with. And in fact, we have a lot of people who have worked in financial services helping us fulfill those, you know, requirements and obligations from an anti-money laundering and all the processes we have around that.
I've been reading reading your annual report and stuff like that. Tell me a little bit about the Flutter Edge thing. It's something you talk about quite a lot, and it seems to me to be kind of a mission statement of standards and thinking and the way you are, your culture. So you're expressing that. Is that what it is? Tell me a little bit about it, and how it actually, you know, it's all very well having it on paper. What's happening in the company today that we'd see the Flutter Edge?
There are lots of good examples of the Flutter Edge, but first let me explain why we even have a Flutter Edge. What's the point of it? And it goes back somewhat to this, of that point I made earlier about sort of the importance of sort of challenger. That sort of challenger thinking, challenger brands. Of course, Paddy Power was a brilliant challenger brand. And so was Betfair. FanDuel itself was. Right? Think about the whole sort of DFS category. You know, when you look down, almost all of our brands, you know, they have that sort of shared DNA about being, you know, so that's a challenger mindset. And what do we mean by that? Well, you know, we mean that, you know, it's a business that deeply understands what their customers want and is serving those customer needs. Often attacking the sort of soft underbelly of the incumbent, right? You know, and it's the sort of rallying cry. The way in which that manifests itself in our business is that we operate an operating structure where we, you know, provide a lot of autonomy to our different brands around the world. So Amy Howe, who runs our business in the US, FanDuel, Amy has everything she needs to be able to run that business. She has her own tech team. She has her own marketing team. She has everything she needs. The same is true for Barney, who runs our business in Australia, and, you know, and on and on, right, around the world. So we don't run lots of things centrally. And I know a lot of businesses do, and they see benefits from that, and they drive efficiencies and that sort of thing. But what we found is that, you know, we're actually able to attack those local incumbents, win the customers and deliver for them by having that autonomy for our local teams. And that's really important to us. You know, we're a high growth business, and actually, you know, taking market share and growing the scale of the business is more important than trying to save a few points from an efficiency perspective. But then, you know, the question then is, you know, with all these different businesses and brands all around the world, Right, and with a degree of autonomy, you can see how we can sort of, we can have a lot of them, right, rather than trying to sort of manage it all centrally.
Mm.
What are the synergies you get from them? If you're not trying to run them all on one tech stack, or you're not trying to, you know, run things centrally. And we look at it through a number of ways, but we describe them collectively as the Flutter Edge. So the Flutter Edge is what makes us more powerful, more valuable than the sum of the parts. First one's about our people. Now, if you go and spend time in FanDuel, you'll hear a lot of Irish accents, you'll hear a lot of British accents, you'll hear a lot of Australian accents. As we found people from our different parts of our organization and we've sent them to America to help support the business. You know, 400 or 500 people are there in FanDuel. So that tacit knowledge that those people have been able to take to FanDuel. You know, we recently acquired MaxBet in Serbia. There's 5 or 6 colleagues from across Flutter who we've seconded into that business, who've been able to take the knowledge and know-how and sort of supercharge MaxBet and their growth in that market. So that's one very important component. From a technology perspective, whilst we don't run central technology, because I wouldn't want to have to make all the trade-offs between, you know, how we would support the new state launch in North Carolina, the regulatory changes we need for the UK, the new product features that the Italians want, you know, whatever the Australians may need next, you know, whatever the question is of what we need to do in India, you know, that would be really difficult. But what's really important is that the teams can effectively steal services and products from each other and pick up the code, pick up the tacit knowledge, understand how to manage it from a risk and trading perspective, and deploy it into their own local code base much more quickly than if they built it themselves. So, you know, a good example of that, you know, here in Ireland actually is, you know, we've got a fantastic new product that we've launched under the Paddy Power brand called Super Sub.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you've seen the advert. It's very funny.
We were talking to Robin about it.
Yeah, it's a brilliant product. Yeah, really getting traction. That product has actually invented, well, the concept was, you know, first come up, you know, in our business in Italy. And it's a product they call Duo for obvious reasons. Sure. Right? And so, you know, it's not actually necessarily about the code to develop the Duo. It's actually about how you manage it from a risk and trading perspective, which is also complex. So we were able to take that and accelerate the deployment of that product here into Paddy Power. So that's a great example from a technology perspective and a product perspective around, you know, the Flutter Edge being there in action. And of course, you know, capital is the other thing. So, you know, you've got the people, you've got technology, you've got some product and capital.
And I guess the again, going back to the roots of Paddy Power, there was always a cheekiness about their marketing and advertising, which just seems to be still there. Is that Do the likes of FanDuel or your other business, do they need a bit of that? Are they already doing that? Or do you help each other out in that sort of thinking as well?
We have to be quite careful that we don't try and help everybody out with everything. Because the more we do that, the more we're requiring our teams to get into more meetings. Mm. And then the more we start looking and feeling like a big business where no one's doing anything other than going to meetings. And I suspect there'll be plenty of your listeners who spend all day going to meetings.
Yeah.
And we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I want people to be figuring out what they need to do to serve their customers. So, you know, you're absolutely right. The mischief team, the team here at Paddy's who come up with all the stunts and brilliant ideas.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely have plausible deniability because I'm never told about any of the exciting things they're going to do.
Yeah.
So I'd have to sign off on it.
Yeah.
No, actually, the team in, you know, Australia have got stuff that they're doing.
Yeah.
The team in Italy will have, you know, their
own
approach.
There's not a central mischief team.
There's no central mischief team.
Okay. Right?
But some of the stuff that we have pioneered over the years, it's been newsworthy here in Paddy Power, we are replicating. Mm. So, you know, actually we paid out on Inter Milan winning Serie A, you know, before they won the competition. You know, Paddy's have done that for years.
Yeah,
right?
So,
justice payouts,
right,
which is something that we were very famous for in Paddy Power. Yeah, they do that regularly in our business in Australia. So some of those themes have been taken up.
Yeah.
You know, the teams understand how to activate them. They speak to the teams here in Dublin and understand what they need to do, and they've been exported.
last question, really, and it's kind of a very general one. The whole thing of remote working, and how has remote working worked for you guys? Are you happy with it? Or is it still in a trial? Do you think it's been good? Do you think it's been not so good? What's your general sense of it?
It felt pretty tricky that that first week when lockdown happened. and you know, we'd never done it before, and we had to practice. And look, I think, you know, if you speak to a lot of our colleagues, they're grateful to be back, you know, in offices. You know, you've seen the fantastic facility we have here in Dublin. You know, I love this office. You know, wherever I am around the world, I'll tell the local team that I love their office, because we have very similar, you know, cool facilities everywhere, which are brilliant for driving collaboration and getting people together. And I'm a big believer that the benefits of sort of the serendipity, the person you bump into when you're queuing for your coffee, or you're getting, you know, you're getting your lunch, you know, they're invaluable to businesses. And so look, we are, you know, encouraging people to spend more time back together.
Peter, that's I promised I wouldn't keep you too long. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it. Enjoyed meeting you. And I can see Flutter is in very good hands.
That's very great. Kind. Thank you very see much.
Thank you, Peter. That was a very, very interesting interview. Really enjoyed that. I have Mark Flood, the founder of Renatus, with me. Mark, you sat here for that interview. What are your key takeaways there, do you think, from that?
Yeah, it was amazing. Like, to think of, we've all seen Paddy Power grow up from what it is to be such a conglomerate today in Flutter and a real global leader. We're seeing a lot across our 9 companies, and there's just so much I think we can learn from the global leaders that are based in Ireland, and lots of lessons from this. I think one that was very interesting was the fact that he was a non-exec, so the business knew him and he knew the business. And I think as we look to the future for succession in both leaders of the business and C-level, I think it could be a good idea to allow some people who might be future players on the executive team to join the board and get a feel, let the company get a feel of them and let them get a feel of the company. I think that's a very interesting model. It's clearly it's been extraordinarily successful for both Flutter and Peter Jackson, and it's one we could take away. Another lesson, I think, it's with such clarity, he said we must have a podium position in each market. And we were equally lucky to have Gene Murta last year at the Real Deal in Goffs, where he had that same clarity of thought. It was just, if we're in a market, we're leader or number two, challenging to be leader. And that clarity that if we're in it, we're leader, and that come what may, that prevails. And another thread back to the Real Deal, where we had Gary McGann speaking, not just on his involvement in Paddy Power Flutter, but his amazing journey with Smurfit. And his line was, the best deals we ever do, we never do. And Peter related to that again, that some of the best deals you do, you never do. And we're looking at we've completed a number of bolt-on acquisitions in recent times. Thankfully, they're all betting in and have been successful. We always talk about the scorecard.
Yeah.
And that clarity of scorecard was very clear. Like, it's probably one of the deals of the decade, what the guys did with FanDuel. And he such clarity on, we know how to run a betting business. We don't have brands. We don't have customers. And learned from the past of trying to establish a brand in a new country, which didn't work in Italy. So he said, we are brilliant operators of a betting business. And so to go into the US to say, let's get something that has a brand, has a customer, and we can run it as a betting business, but equally had downside risk covered.
Yeah.
You know, the clarity. So what looked like a lot of big bets can be kind of somewhat punts, but it just, the clarity of scorecard on what they were looking for, it was somewhat de-risked and it ticked the boxes of the scorecard. Yeah. And I just think, as the lessons for our companies who want to be acquisitive, is just that clarity on scorecard, and if we get anywhere near that, we hopefully we're inspired by that. And I think also the, you know, strategy is not overnight, sticking with it. Mm. You know, it's absolutely put a lot of thought into it, commit. Like, it could have been so easy for the guys to kind of dip back out of the US. But yeah, it's sticking to the strategy was so important. And understanding the US, like a lot of businesses, thankfully we've had good success entering the US most recently with Renix. And but again, it's state by state, so you need to really, really understand. It's not about the US, it's about understanding all of the states. Mm. And you just need to really, really look at it as not one country, mm, but a collection of countries. Final one is again, on we are acquiring and we are integrating a lot of businesses, and there's always the temptation to go for the huge centralized synergies. Clearly, Peter and his team have resisted that, but they've got the best and the cross-fertilization from their people to the tech, to the product, to the marketing and the capital. So I just think it's down to judgment. Mm. You can clearly hear there that it's not divisional. They don't have that central marketing, mm, that central product, that central tech, but they clearly have enough leadership, enough maturity to share learnings. And that's just about leadership and playing as a team to get the best of the collective, but not slow down by centralizing. So I think it's you've done a lot of good podcasts, but I think this is one for the MBAs to listen to.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Mark.